Welcome to Triumphs and Tragedies, a 20-part podcast series on the history of the Catholic Church. I'm Father Dwight Longenecker. This 20-part series is looking at basically one century of this 2,000-year history of the Catholic Church per episode. Therefore, it might actually go more than 20 parts because some of the centuries will be full of different events and we might have to spin it out a little bit longer. But we're doing pretty well so far, and this is the sixth episode, which is focusing on the fifth century, the years 400 to 500. As we come to the end of this episode, you can see that we're therefore coming to the end of the first quarter of the church history, the first 500 years. These first 500 years have been very momentous, and if you would like to follow the rest of the episodes, then you can do so at my iTunes channel. Just go to iTunes and search Longenecker or Father Longenecker, and you will be taken over there and see the other episodes of Triumphs and Tragedies. You can also listen at Breadbox Media, and the episodes are also posted on my blog as blog posts. You can also tune in at Player FM on the Catholic channel and find all of those episodes there. You'll also find at iTunes and at Player FM and on my blog my homilies week by week from Our Lady of the Rosary, where I am the pastor. In addition to these podcasts, you can also follow a particular special blog post on each one of the episodes on the church history division of my blog. I post there a few more thoughts about each of the episodes. Also, I include resources, online resources, other podcasts, and books to read if you're interested in taking this study of church history a bit further. I'd like to take a moment and remind you why we're actually doing this podcast. It's because I'm convinced that a lot of Catholics are fairly ignorant about church history, and to learn about church history helps us to understand what's happening in the church today. Because with the 2,000-year history of the Catholic Church, you can bet that almost all of the issues that we face today are things which, in one way or another, we've faced in the past, and the church has dealt with them. And these same heresies, these same corruption and persecution and problems crop up time and time again. In each one of the episodes, we focused on one particular triumph and tragedy that has gone on in each one of those episodes. You might remember the episode of the first century was dealing with the problems in the Acts of the Apostles, how the church was going to cope with the call for the message to go beyond the Jews out to the Gentiles and to the rest of the world. We also went on, therefore, in the next episode to look at the problem of Gnosticism. Gnosticism being a kind of vague spiritual movement in the hurly-burly of the Roman Empire, in which there were many different religions and many different spiritualities. And how did Christianity cope with that? Especially as Christianity argued that it was, the Christians argued that theirs was a historical faith grounded in reality, not just in spiritual theories or vague spirituality or teachings about angels and demons and all the rest of those vague spiritual realities, but ours was a faith which is rooted in history. We went on then to consider the century from 200 to 300. This was an age of persecution when the church was growing amazingly across the Roman Empire and was able to do so because it focused on the concrete realities of the faith, on a canon of scripture, on a hierarchy of the clergy, and also on increasingly a defined doctrine and dogma, which helped Christians to know what they actually believed. During this time period, persecution increased and intensified terribly, and so we discussed the problems of persecution for the church and how, in an ironic and providential way, that actually strengthened the church to move forward, to become the global phenomenon that it did when it was eventually made the established religion of the Roman Empire, which happened around the beginning of the 300s. We talked in the last episode about century from 300 to 400, and particularly the problem of Arianism, a religion which was a form of Christianity which was heretical and which did not really teach that Jesus was God incarnate. Instead, Jesus was a created being. And the great heroic Bishop Athanasius is the hero of that century, who just stubbornly and persistently holds to the orthodox historic faith of Jesus being true God and true man. And therefore, the Nicene Creed, which we recite every week at Mass, comes from the beginning of that century. So we're going to move on now in this sixth episode of Triumphs and Tragedies to consider the years 400 to 500. But to do that, effectively, we have to actually backtrack a little bit and go back to some of the other momentous events and momentous figures of the century before, the century from the 300 to 400s. You might remember that at the beginning of the century, with the conversion of Constantine and his mother, Christianity eventually becomes the tolerated in the Roman Empire, and there was no more persecution. But it wasn't until 380, the year 380 AD, that the emperor Theodosius actually proclaims Christianity to be the official religion of the empire. So during this time, in the 300s, there was still controversy back and forth. Constantine was succeeded by Constantius as the emperor, and he outlaws paganism. But then in 360, another emperor comes to the throne, Julian the Apostate, who tries to reverse the spread of Christianity and bring back paganism. But he's only emperor for 3 years, and his reforms failed. And eventually, about 20 years later, as I've said, Christianity is proclaimed as the official religion of the empire. Now, during this time period, again, in the 4th century, in the 300s, we have a couple of other very important figures who we have to take time to talk about. And one of those, born in 331, is Saint Jerome. Saint Jerome is an incredible figure from the early church, a scholar of the ancient languages and a controversialist. He is a radical and extreme Christian in his early years. He's beginning to spend time with the monks in Syria. And in the second part of this podcast, we'll be talking more about monasticism, but for the time being, let's just say that the monks in Syria were a very serious group of Christians. They were hermits. They were ascetics. They lived in caves. They were took their faith radically, and Jerome joined them. But his scholarship and his restlessness meant that he was moving around the Roman Empire and making some contacts in high places. One of them being Pope Damasus, and Pope Damasus, in 380, commissions Jerome to actually translate the Bible into Latin. And so Jerome begins his monumental and heroic task of translating the Old Testament and the New Testament into Latin. This is the Latin version of the Bible, which would be kept to right through the Middle Ages and right into the modern age. It's known as the Vulgate. And the Jerome's Latin translation of the Bible is a monumental masterpiece of Western literature and of Christian literature. But Jerome's an interesting character because not only translates the Bible, he's writing other theological treatises. We have his homilies and sermons, and he's also a very quarrelsome and cantankerous person who eventually retires to Bethlehem, where he sets up a little religious community with some religious ladies and some others, and continues his scholarship and his work and his controversy from that location there in Bethlehem, right to the end of the century. Around the middle of the 4th century, in 354, another huge figure from the early church is Saint Augustine. Saint Augustine, in his early years, is attracted by Manichaeism. Now, Manichaeism is worth discussing for a moment because it's a very interesting illustration of the way Gnosticism continued to influence the early church and the culture of the Roman Empire. The prophet Mani, M-A-N-I, is the founder of Manichaeism, and he is located in what is present-day Iran or Persia, and his religion that he brings together is typical of Gnosticism in that as much as it's dualistic, it believes that the physical world is evil, and it's a blend of Judaism, Christianity, and Zoroastrianism. And Manichaeism was very influential across the eastern part of the Roman Empire, in Persia, Asia Minor, and Syria. And the monks of Syria that were where Jerome was located, and all the early monks were heavily influenced by this Manichaeism, which, if they were not actually Manichees themselves, it was influenced by that philosophy. Therefore, the early monastic movement was regarded the physical world and their bodies as, in many times, sinful, and that accounted for the extreme asceticism that they went in for. Again, we'll talk more about this in the second part of the podcast, but Saint Augustine, who is born in 354, is caught up in this same turmoil between the pleasure of the human flesh and physical body, and the demands of a spiritual life, which in his viewpoint seems to call him to suppress his physical desires. Saint Augustine is the one who famously said, "Lord, make me chaste, but not yet." And so he has a mistress and a son, and he's struggling with his physical desires and his lusts and his the pleasure of life. And this is a conflict constantly within Augustine's writings and within his life, and something which Christians are going to face right down through the ages, the struggle between the physical and the spiritual, trying to draw together the mystery of the incarnation, which says, yes, the physical matter is good, the created world is good, and yet it's fallen into sin, and it's fallen into distortion, and into the dark side. And we can't go into dualism, which says that the physical world is evil, but we do have to struggle with our physical desires, which very often lead us into a path of sin and sadness and hurt and woundedness. And Augustine is going to struggle with this all through his life in one way or another. Augustine eventually does convert under the influence of Saint Ambrose of Milan, who's another great figure of this time period. And towards the end of the 300s, he is the leading theologian in the church, kind of picking up the mantle from Jerome and moving on to defend the Orthodox faith. And one of the conflicts that he comes into is the conflict with Pelagianism. Pelagius was a British monk who began to think about the interaction of human free will and grace, God's grace. And Pelagius basically is sticking up for human free will. He says that we have, although we've fallen into sin, he says we have the ability to choose what is good. We have the ability to reason over what is truthful. We have the ability to draw near to God in our own strength. And although we're sinners, we still have that ability. Augustine corrects that and says, no, man does not have the ability to choose good and to reason to the good on his own. He says that this needs to be empowered by grace. Therefore, Augustine is very often called the apostle of grace, because he brings this insight into the faith, that the understanding is that although we're created good, by original sin we have fallen into darkness, and we have fallen into a darkened mind and a darkened desire. And it's only by God's grace that we can actually begin to understand the truth and understand God's working in the world and accept God's love. This is very important, because the outcome of Pelagianism is really a religion of good works. And that's why Pelagianism is sometimes typified as saying it's a religion of good works. It's important for us as Catholics, because very often our non-Catholic brothers and sisters will blame us of following a religion of good works. And we have to correct them and say, no, Catholicism has never, from Augustine onward, has never taught a religion of good works. We believe in a religion of grace, and grace that empowers us to understand God's love, and empowers us to respond to God's love, and empowers us to do good works in the world. But the good works that we do are always, we have to stress, empowered by God's grace at work in us. So these theological events and controversies are going on towards the end of the 300s and on into the 400s. And so we come to, therefore, this 5th century, the events in the between the 400s and 500s. Augustine is still active, and these debates are still going on theologically. But some other debates are going on as well, and we have to also touch on the important political events that are taking place during this time, because they affect what's happening in the church. By this time, the Roman Empire is beginning to disintegrate, and the invasions of the barbarians from the north and the east are pressing in not only on the Roman territories of Britain and northern Europe and the Far East, but they're actually beginning to come in and threaten Rome itself. And so in the year 410, Alaric, the Goth, besieges Rome for the first time. And therefore, Rome itself and is being threatened by invasion. And in 429 and 430, the Vandals sack Rome. Rome is therefore broken, and the Roman Empire is obviously beginning to crumble all around them. And as the Roman Empire crumbles, the entire infrastructure begins to seize up and just not work anymore. There's no money to pay the troops. There's no money to maintain the infrastructure of the city. And so into this chaos comes Pope Leo, Pope Leo the Great. He becomes pope in the year 440, just about in the middle of this century. And Pope Leo the Great is from an aristocratic family, and basically he finds himself in a society which is broken and crumbling, and he steps into the breach and says, well, somebody has to take charge. Somebody has to make things work again. And so Pope Leo is the first pope to really assume temporal power as well as spiritual power in the world. And it has to be stressed that as Pope Leo the Great assumes temporal power, he does so because of the situation of chaos in the world. It's not like he was grasping for power. Later popes certainly will do that, but we see Pope Leo really taking responsibility for the city of Rome and for the chaos which was all around him. This is sometimes why Leo is called the first pope. In a sense, he's the first pope that takes on temporal power. And non-Catholics like to say, well, there wasn't any pope really until the 5th century with Pope Leo. This isn't really true. The other popes before him were the leaders of the church, and the leader had spiritual power but did not really assume much temporal power in the church. And it's Pope Leo who is the first who really takes charge in that sense. He is the one who, with the threat of Attila the Hun, travels in 451 to actually meet with Attila the Hun and persuade him not to sack Rome. And so he therefore not only takes charge of the infrastructure and the politics and the governance of Rome, but he also has a very important role to play theologically. To be able to understand all of what is going on with Pope Leo theologically, well, we have to backtrack a little bit and go back into the realm of theology. The church in the 5th century is still continuing to debate the exact role of Jesus as the Son of God. Remember, the Arian controversy in the 4th century was all about whether Jesus was a created being or not, and in what sense he was God incarnate. And this continues on into the 4th century when the heresy of Nestorianism begins to crop up. And Nestorianism, put very simply, downplays the divinity of Christ, and downplays his incarnation, trying to again understand exactly what the relationship of Jesus' humanity and divinity is. And you can look into this in more detail, and on my blog I'll have a special blog post, as I always do, about this episode, and I'm going to delve into more detail about the Nestorian controversy, because I don't have time in the podcast to go into it in very much detail, but very put very simply, Nestorianism downplays Christ's divinity. And there are two key players, Dioscorus and Flavian, who are debating this back and forth. And the church is, again, in uproar about this particular detail of doctrine. And it's important, however, to have it pinned down and to have it actually defined. And while this debate is going back and forth, it is Pope Leo who actually writes a document which is called Leo's Tome, in which he goes through and makes the distinctions that are necessary and defines the doctrine of Jesus Christ actually having two natures, but the two combined in a single union. And this controversy is defined finally and pinned down at the Council of Chalcedon in 451. And basically what happened was Leo's delegates go and read his theological document, Leo's Tome, and the fathers of the church are for the most part united, saying that Peter has spoken through Leo. So the Leo's Tome not only helped to define the doctrinal dispute at that point, but also consolidated papal authority. When they said Peter has spoken through Leo, they're not only recognizing the Pope as the final authority in this doctrinal matter, but remember, Leo's temporal power has also grown, and through Leo the Great, the papacy emerges as the great power and the authority in the church now in this 5th century. So Pope Leo the Great from 440 to 461 is this monumental figure in the 5th century who really establishes the authority of the Pope and the authority of the Roman Church as the Roman Empire is continuing to disintegrate. Well, while this temporal authority is being established and theological authority is being established in Rome under Leo the Great, another trend is also happening in the church, which is going to be very important for the establishment of the church in the Middle Ages, and that is the growth of monasticism. When the Christian church becomes the church of the Roman Empire, lots of well-off people, lots of aristocrats, and lots of people who wanted to get somewhere in the world suddenly become Christians. And the church begins to assume more worldly power, as we've seen. It also begins to assume more wealth, and the bishops of the church become very influential, and some of them very wealthy. They become benefactors, and the church becomes the established church, and the church of the wealthy, and the church of the well-to-do, and the church of the well-educated. And in the midst of all of this, of course, some Christians are saying, this is not really the way of Christ. This is not really the way of the gospel. We're going to go out and leave all this behind, and we're going to establish ourselves living a radical Christian life, a prophetic life, like John the Baptist in the wilderness. And so begins the rise of Christian monasticism. I've already pointed out how it was influenced by the dualism of Manichaeism, believing that the physical world and our bodies were somehow sinful. And so this early stage of monasticism with Anthony of Egypt, St. Anthony of Egypt, around 356, again, in the middle of the 4th century, begins to emerge. St. Jerome, remember, is identifying with the monks in the Syrian desert. Some of them were very extreme. And in the middle of this century, around 459, for instance, we have St. Simeon Stylites, who lived on a pillar in the Syrian desert for 37 years. And these monks early monks used to almost compete with each other in how extreme their asceticism could be. Another important figure is Pachomius in around the 340s, who gathers these hermits together into a loose-knit community of hermits, observing a life of prayer and asceticism, trying to live an extreme gospel witness. A little bit later, we have Saint Basil in the East, who insists that the hermits are too extreme and they should live together in community life. They should be cenobitic monks that are living together in community. And St. Basil establishes a rule for monastic life, which becomes the Basilian rule in the East as one of the basics, the basic foundations for monastic life in the East. A couple of other figures are, as we move into the 5th century, are St. John Cassian. He also establishes a monastic community, but this time in France. And St. Augustine himself, also in Africa, in the mid-5th century, establishes a monastic community. And it is from this that we have the Augustinian monks, who follow the monastic rule of St. Augustine. In Ireland, at the same time, is St. Patrick. An important figure towards the end of the 5th century. He learns about monasticism in France, and he goes back as the missionary to the Irish, and he establishes the great Celtic monasteries, and which would be a great movement in Christianity in the early Middle Ages. So St. Patrick also is in this century, towards the end of the century. He dies in 493, also then at the end of the 400s is the birth of Saint Benedict in Norcia in Italy, and Saint Benedict is going to emerge as a very important figure in monasticism, drawing together these different strands into what will become the Benedictine movement and be so important in the Middle Ages. So to review, we find that in this 5th century the Roman Empire is beginning to crumble. The Goths and the Vandals and the Huns are all invading, and from the north, in the Picts and the Scots are gnawing away at the Roman Empire in Britain, and the barbarians from the Goths from northern Europe are beginning to sweep south, and the Roman Empire is disintegrating and falling into corruption and falling into decay as the barbarians invade. And the church, therefore, responds to this calamity in the and collapse of the Roman Empire in these two different ways. One is the emergence of strong bishops and strong theologians who are continuing to establish doctrinal orthodoxy in the church through the controversy with Pelagius and also the controversy with Nestorianism. But alongside that theological orthodoxy, which is being establishing a firm foundation for the future, emerges Pope Leo the Great. The papacy begins to emerge now as not only establishing theological orthodoxy, but also beginning to shore up and pick up the remnants and the ruins of the crumbling Roman Empire, and beginning to feed the hungry, to establish a begin to establish a political base and foundation for the future, and trying to build something out of the ruins. And so these two particular strands of the theological foundation, which is now being established through the controversies over Nestorianism and Pelagianism, and on the other hand, the emergence of a strong papacy, begin to build a foundation for what will then become the Church of the Middle Ages. The third strand in all of this, as we've pointed out, is monasticism. And God's hand is at work in all of this, so that we see this monasticism arising in the first and the fourth century, and then continuing into the fifth century, all over the Roman Empire. So it's not just St. Anthony in Egypt, but it's all there's also the Syrian monks, it's St. John Cassian in France, it's St. Patrick in Ireland and in Britain. And so all across the empire, this form of monasticism seems to be emerging as the church becomes the established church of the Roman Empire. This alternative spirituality begins to emerge, which is going to be so important, because monasticism is going to be the lifeblood of the church and the spirituality of the church. It's, as St. Therese says, the beating heart of the church. And this monasticism will be so important as we move into the next episode, looking at the 6th century and the beginning of the church in the Middle Ages. what is the safe for the church in our age today? Well, as we've said before, in many ways, the culture in which we live is looking like the collapse of the Roman Empire. It's not as bad as it was because the infrastructures that we value are still in place. The political infrastructure, the technological infrastructure, the educational infrastructure, the military and police infrastructure, all these things which are necessary for an ordered society are still in place. But we are seeing the moral collapse in the West, in Europe, and in the United States, which was also part of the collapse of the Roman Empire. In the Roman Empire, the collapse came from within, and it was a moral collapse which went along with a huge wealth and affluence. Came the collapse of the family, the collapse of morality, the collapse of personal responsibility, and all of these these moral indicators are there in our society as well. And so, what is the response? Well, we also see a theological response, as we saw in the Roman Empire, of Pelagianism, which is a religion of good works, which is an easy kind of religion, where liberals in the church have turned Christianity into a kind of what's called a moral therapeutic deism, in which religion has been reduced to simply a religion of good works, like Pelagianism, or a religion in which Jesus isn't really God, he's just a good teacher, like Arianism, and other moral confusion where and theological confusion where the church leaders are too wealthy, are too ensconced in the establishment, are too locked into the wealth and the establishment and the privilege that goes along with that, and therefore the faith becomes blurry, it becomes ambiguous, it becomes watered down. And what's the response to all of these things, which are happening in our society, just like they happened in Roman society in the 3rd, 4th, and 5th centuries? Well, we see the same thing emerging as emerged then. You might be familiar with a book by a friend of mine, Rod Dreher, which is called The Benedict Option, and he lays out some of these same themes and calls for a return to basic communities, basic Christian communities, which he roots in the option of Saint Benedict, which we'll look at more in the next episode. But we also see an increase of vocations in the monastic and religious orders. The Dominicans, for instance, are enjoying a wonderful increase in vocations. I'm hearing that a number of the Benedictine monasteries are enjoying an increase in vocations, and there are some wonderful examples of extreme monasticism going on in our age. The monks at Norcia, for instance, who've returned to St. Benedict's birthplace and are establishing really quite radical monastic life. The monks at Clear Creek Monastery in Oklahoma and various other traditional orders are enjoying an upsurge of young vocations as monasticism begins to show itself as the answer to a decadent age. And I believe this will increase. And if you tune in next time to Triumphs and Tragedies, we're going to talk about the rise of the monastic movement even more and the importance of Saint Benedict. So I hope you've been enjoying the series so far. I'm Father Dwight Longenecker. You're listening to Triumphs and Tragedies. I encourage you to go to my blog, dwightlongenecker.com. You will find there my blogs almost every day on various issues of the church and culture, also my podcasts. And I'd like to let you know also about the opportunity to be a donor subscriber to my blog. If you subscribe to my blog, there's a monthly fee, but you have access to a whole range of other archived articles which I post. Also, you have access to my church history section where I blog further about my podcast. And also, it helps to fund the production of these podcasts and the promotion of these podcasts. And I invite you to do so. Donor subscribers have various other benefits which you can learn about on my blog. Just go to the blog and click on the menu to subscribe, and you'll learn there how you can do that. If you can afford to do so, you're also helping to provide my blog and my podcast for free to all of those who can't afford to do so. So I invite you to do that and encourage you to subscribe if you possibly can. Just to let you know also about something else which is coming up with my podcasts, which have been a pretty good success so far, I'm also planning to begin another series of podcasts which are called Father Longenecker's True Fairy Tales. And this is a creative enterprise I'm going to be doing, which is just basically telling stories as podcasts. And some of them will be classic fairy tales from the Brothers Grimm and from Hans Christian Andersen. But some will also be from George MacDonald, who was a great influence on C.S. Lewis, and some of my own stories that I've written as well. And the stories will be told, not read, which means there will be the same informality of a podcast. And I hope they will be things that you'll like to listen to, but also maybe listen to with your kids and your grandkids. If you're in the car, if you're traveling, if you've got the school commute, or if you're just sitting at home and you want to turn off the screens and listen to a great story, then I hope that you'll tune in to Father Longenecker's True Fairy Tales. Thanks for listening to Triumphs and Tragedies. And be in touch, browse my books, and go over to my blog at dwightlongenecker.com.